and welcome to Comic Talk Today. This is Martin, and I haven't been on the show in forever. But today we have a special episode for you. And so Dustin let me come on the show and share this interview that I did with David Peepos, of course, writer of Spencer and Locke, Go to the Chapel, etc. But he's got a new Kickstarter out called The OZ, and it looks amazing. So David and I sat down, we had a chat about the book. I hope you will enjoy the discussion. Please check the show notes for links to the new Kickstarter project. It looks amazing. The art's great, the story's great, and David's really passionate about what he does. So without further ado, enjoy the interview.
But no, thank you so much for chatting with me, man. I really appreciate it. I'm so excited to talk with you about this book. This book has been in the works for a very long time, and I'm really excited to show it off.
So I was talking to Ronnie earlier because I asked if he wanted to come on.
Yeah.
Apparently work is more important than you, David. That's what he told me.
Clearly I know who my friends are. I guess Robbie can have a roof over his head and pay his bills. Yes, he'll just have to wait for the Kickstarter then.
That's right.
No problem.
I remember you mentioning this book. I don't think you had anything done yet, but yeah. I remember you talking about it, not this past C2E2, but 2019.
This book has been in the works. So, actually first I should ask, so we're recording right now, right?
We're always recording, my friend.
Okay, perfect. Okay, great. So for those who don't know what this book is, I'm David Peppos. I'm the writer of Spencer and Locke and Going to the Chapel over at Action Lab. And I'm here to promote the Kickstarter for my new book, The OZ.
Yes.
Which is What If Mad Max Took Place in The Wizard of Oz. And
nice.
I'm really stoked about this book. I've been working on this actually since 2017.
Jesus.
This book has been long in the making. For those who don't know kind of my bibliography, my breakout book, Spencer and Locke, was What If Calvin and Hobbes Grew Up in Sin City?
Yes. And, best book of the decade.
I appreciate you saying that. That means the world. It's the sort of book that, I did not know how that was going to turn out. When you have a high concept like that, you either succeed or you fail, but you do so loudly.
Sure.
And so I was like on pins and needles that whole series because I was just like, are people going to like it? Are they going to respond to it? Are they going to run me out of the industry? Is this the only comic I'm ever going to get to write? Am I going to get pilloried so hard in the press that I'll never want to write a book again? And thankfully, people seemed to really like that book. They really responded well to it. And so at the time, I said to myself, oh, okay, maybe I'll be a writer. And so at the time, I came up with three ideas to work on kind of concurrently. One of them was Spencer and Locke Volume 2, where we kind of did Calvin and Hobbes versus Beetle Bailey.
Mm-hmm.
The second book was Going to the Chapel, yep. Which is Die Hard at a Wedding. And this, the OZ. The high concept of the OZ, it reframes the original L. Frank Baum's Wizard of Oz. You all know the story of Dorothy Gale getting swept up by a tornado. She crash lands in Oz. She meets three extraordinary friends, and they go off and kill the Wicked Witch of the West. And then Dorothy clicks her heels three times and leaves. And that's where the story of the OZ begins. I thought a lot about that sort of additional high concept. And I thought, if you've ever seen the Wizard of Oz movie, if you've ever read the books, they try to wrap everything up in a really neat little bow.
Yes.
And the thing is that if you saw something like that in real life, it would play out like Baghdad. the thing is like, Dorothy Gale was a child. There's no way that she would know. So I wouldn't consider her complicit in any of this. But what she did to the Wicked Witch was kind of like almost a political assassination.
Right.
And the fact that she then leaves, there it invites a power vacuum. And it kind of leads it's kind of Game of Thrones Civil War. You know, everybody wants their shot at the throne. Everybody wants control. Everybody wants power. And instead of sort of, you know, lining up in front of this kind of powerful tyrant like the Wicked Witch, you know, suddenly all that power has been decentralized. And so the OZ picks up a generation later. And we follow Dorothy's granddaughter and namesake. You know, unlike her grandmother, you know, this is not sort of this wide-eyed innocent girl from Kansas. This is somebody who she's an Iraq war veteran, and she's really kind of disillusioned, and she's grappling with trauma and guilt from her time overseas. She's come back to Kansas to take care of her ailing grandmother. But Dorothy just doesn't, you know, she's looking for purpose. She's looking to really put the pieces of her life back together. And so one night she's driving through the cornfield, and she's swept up by a hurricane or by a tornado. And she's dropped into the war-torn land of Oz. And she's going to find out that her grandmother's stories of this magical world on the other side of the rainbow aren't quite as rose-colored as she thought. So Dorothy's going to have to really, she's going to have to confront her past. She's going to have to confront the morality of war. She's going to have to navigate her grandmother's former friends if she hopes to survive and perhaps bring peace to the occupied zone, or as the locals call it, the OZ.
That is, that's quite a pitch, David. I love it. Thank you. Yeah, I'm really happy that you're finally getting to put this book out, and the Kickstarter's coming out. Well, actually, it'll be out the day that I put this episode out.
Perfect.
So that'll float in nicely.
Yeah.
I like that you're bringing in some of the adult themes from The Wizard of Oz into the story, and I mean, the way you pitched it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, well, but, you know, it's – oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, the thing is, I've read – the Wizard of Oz books more than just the original one. I took a class in adolescent literature in college, and I actually wrote a term paper on how the Land of Oz is kind of like a prototypical superhero universe because of all the different like factions and species and power sets going on throughout this kind of wild, crazy world. It reminded me a lot of the Marvel Universe.
Right.
And yeah, it's, you know, but those future Oz books, you know, they deal with war and sort of these kind of the friction of the political friction going on. But for the OZ, we're like taking it kind of more in like a Mad Max or Star Wars Rogue One kind of venue. Mm-hmm. The thing is, and I've said this a lot about my previous work with Spencer and Locke, I'm not looking to do gritty interpretations of children's books for the sake of shock value. That's the furthest thing I want, because shock doesn't build investment.
Right.
Shock can get people interested for one issue. It will not bring them back for more. You have to actually have a theme and an actual point to justify this. And, you know, by virtue of sort of taking this kind of mashup of the fantasy genre and the war genre, we're able to add, I think, some really nice themes that sort of builds upon some of my previous bibliography. You know, the idea of trauma and guilt from your past. How do you overcome that? But I think for the OZ, we get to build on that by saying, you know, Dorothy is seen almost as royalty.
Right.
In Oz. You know, her grandmother liberated the country, and you know, I don't think anybody in Oz blames the original Dorothy for what happened next. And yet, our Dorothy, our new Dorothy, she's kind of struggling with this burden of responsibility, this weight of leadership, because it just exacerbates all the things she saw in Iraq and Afghanistan, where how do you make the right choices in war when every decision you make ends up with someone dead? You know, it's sort of that calculus that soldiers on the ground have to go through every single day. They have to watch out for their own lives, the lives of their fellow soldiers. They have to look out, figure out what's up with, you know, who's the enemy here, who's just some unlucky bystander who's managed to kind of wander into the crossfire. And that's just the day-to-day element. That's not even thinking about the long-term greater good. And that's something that the OZ is going to analyze a bit. It's just, you know, what's the right decision here? Can you break free from the cycle of violence? It's one thing to sort of fight to and live to fight another day, but how do you, winning the war might not be as important as stopping it.
Well, actually, that's kind of funny that you mentioned that, because I was thinking of this book in terms of you and what you are known for.
Yeah.
You know, going to the chapel was a little bit of a departure from Spencer and Locke.
Sure.
And it was a fantastic book, but I think what really put you on the map for me and folks around me was Spencer and Locke. And
sure.
So there's, I think, as a writer, somewhat of an expectation to follow along those same lines. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with Stephanie Phillips, but
she's
kind of become known for this kind of thing also, right? Where she takes historical characters and places them in this kind of alternate reality fiction.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you say that, because I think there are certain themes that play through my work, even lighter fare, like Going to the Chapel, I think is very much rooted in Emily, our sort of our conflicted bride, who becomes the ringleader of our own hostage situation to get out of getting married.
Mm-hmm.
Her commitment issues all come from past trauma. It's that, you know, her ex-boyfriend Tom vanished without any word, and it's because he took the fall for a bank robbery. You know, like, she didn't know that, but that trauma really kind of gave her commitment issues all the way to the story's present. So I think past trauma is something that always really interests me as a storyteller. You know, I studied a lot of psychology in college. I thought I was going to be a psych major for a while. And when I was a newspaper reporter, I actually covered the mental health and military beats. And so I think those things, particularly interviewing soldiers who are coming back home, you know, and struggling to kind of adjust back to, especially in rural Massachusetts, where, like, they don't necessarily get the spotlight or the tax dollars or the infrastructure that a place like Boston might.
Right.
I think those stories really stuck with me, and I think they certainly kind of colored the themes that I would go on to explore. You know, it's the thing about taking sort of these childhood icons and taking them through heavier subject matter, something that kind of appeals to me, and I imagine it appeals to writers like Ed Brubaker or Mark Russell or Tom King or Roberto and Gary Sacasa, you know, the showrunner of Riverdale and the writer of Afterlife with Archie.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I like about this sort of subgenre, as it were, is that, you know, nostalgia is kind of like it's a shared memory, you know. It's a memory that I think we all have of a time when the world was simpler and less complicated, and maybe safer.
Yeah, and I think you went to school and you wanted to be a psychologist, so I'm sure you're familiar with this. It's kind of like when you smell cookies, you get this like warm feeling inside of you, right?
Yeah, you know, it's the sense memories.
Yeah,
and that's a great way to look at it, because, you know, these childhood icons are also, they're populated by these really strong, iconic archetypes. And I think by taking these kind of characters that we all universally know and bring them through heavier subject matter, I think that lets audiences do a deeper dive. Because we know instinctively these symbols are not going to break. You know, no matter what happens with the OZ, while I think it's some of my best work yet, if somebody doesn't like it, it's not going to erase their good memories of the Judy Garland film, mm-hmm. for example. And I think by virtue of us knowing that, hey, those archetypes are still safe, we can then follow these different interpretations and go places that other characters can't. And I think the great thing about the archetypes, specifically of the Wizard of Oz, is these characters, you know, they each have very strong characteristics and qualities. And then you put them together, and they're sort of like this jam band team. They're, you know, you could look at it as like, you know, the classic Claremont X-Men, or you could look at it as Chrono Trigger, which is one of my favorite role-playing games, is a big influence on this book. Or, you know, Final Fantasy VII, or mm-hmm. Final Fantasy Remake, if you played that. You know, so you're able to take these qualities that really, you know, exemplify these characters, and you can take them to the logical extreme, or you can kind of zig where people expect you to zag, and it both feels organic. You know, like for the example of Dorothy, you know, I think most people see her as this kind of wide-eyed young woman, you know, very innocent, you know, very good-natured, doesn't have a mean bone in her body. Our Dorothy, you know, has seen some stuff, and the thing she kind of drives the engine of the OZ in a storytelling perspective, because she's got that military training and she's got that military way of thinking. And so while the Land of Oz is already kind of a dangerous place, she sees that magic and she can see a weapon to defend herself. It reminds me a little bit of the Matt Fraction Hawkeye run.
Oh, yeah. Where
he says, what kind of person do you have to be to see everything in the room as a weapon? And that's Dorothy. She's got that kind of situational awareness. Meanwhile, you know, you've got the Tin Soldier, who's kind of one of my favorite characters in this book, where he's been blown up and put back together so many times that he's kind of unrecognizable. He's turned into almost like a human tank. He's just been kind of cobbled together with whatever metal has been around. And yet he's also the guy he wanted heart. And what happens to that guy when he's seen years of bloody conflict and watched friends die right in front of him?
Is that who's on the cover of the book?
Yep. It's Dorothy and the Tin Soldier on the cover of our book. But we've got plenty of other familiar faces we'll be checking in on. You know, the Scarecrow is kind of one of my favorite characters in the book. He's a very complicated figure. And I think readers' relationship with the Scarecrow will evolve over the course of our three Kickstarter campaigns across our three issues. Because, yeah, he's the guy who wanted a brain.
Right.
And, you know, the problem with smart people or people who think they're smart is they think they have no limits. And, you know, the Scarecrow will have found over the course of, you know, the generation that has passed, it's a real monkey's paw situation for him.
No pun intended, right?
Yeah. No monkey's paw. But, you know, he is kind of realized he's hitting the limits of his intelligence here. And I think he's realizing there's a gap that he'll never be able to cover. And so I think, you know, he's a very interesting character, and I think he's almost like the biggest departure we take in this series. But I think it's all for the greater good as far as the story is concerned.
The thing is, I think books that deal with this kind of thing of retelling familiar children's stories, and you know, Spencer and Locke was kind of a similar theme.
Sure.
And you know, even going to the chapel with the Die Hard themes, right? But taking this thing that you loved as a kid and bringing it to a new format for readers that are adults, because you know, even though comics are, I would say, still seen kind of as children's fare, most people buying comics are adults.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. You know, it's for me, it's all about accessibility. You know, my mission for comics has always been, at least for my career, I want to invite as many people to the table as possible. I want to build a wider consensus. And so the way that I often pitch my work to people is I try to think of what's considered a comp title. You know, do you like Calvin and Hobbes? Do you like Die Hard? Do you like Ocean's 11? Do you like Mad Max? I feel like trying to kind of meet people in the middle with something that's fairly universal, I think, has been really helpful for me in terms of triangulating the direction of my scripts.
Right.
It's not to say that every book that I'm working on is a pastiche or a parody or an homage, but I think for me, because I come to this with this kind of mashup ethos, that's always been really helpful for me. You know, having two very distinct influences and then throwing them together, it means that I've always got room to maneuver. You know, for the OZ, I consider it, I have actually kind of like four different axes to operate on. If the fantasy elements aren't working, I can switch gears to something military. If that's not working, I can look at the history of Oz. And if that's not working, I can just dig into Dorothy's head and just sort of see how she's seeing this world and how she's grappling with her own inner demons from her time in Iraq. And that's really given me a lot of dramatic potential to work with.
Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I've written this whole book already.
Yeah.
The book is written and done. And I'm really happy with kind of this hero's journey that Dorothy's taken, because we've been able to switch between these different avenues and it still all feels organic.
So why go the Kickstarter route on this?
Sure. You know, it's a confluence of things. I feel like I've been looking at Kickstarter for a long time. I have a lot of friends who have had a lot of success on that platform. My friend Charlie Stickney from White Ash. My buddy Rylan Grant just did an amazing Kickstarter campaign called The Jump. Russell Nohelty, who's got a laundry list of success on Kickstarter, such as Cthulhu's Hard to Spell, mm-hmm. or his Ichabod Jones series. I have a ton of friends out here in LA who they've all had success on the platform. And the way that Charlie and Russell in particular explained it to me is, you know, Kickstarter is very much its own marketplace. You have people who buy books, you know, primarily at comic shops. You have people who primarily buy books on Amazon, or, you know, I've been really lucky, you know, people who buy books exclusively at conventions. And then there are people who buy exclusively on Kickstarter. And so, I've been thinking about that for a long time. And then when COVID hit, it really kind of crystallized that line of thinking for me. Not only, you know, did it empower me as a creator, but I quickly realized, you know, the things that we've taken for granted in the comics industry are not necessarily as rock solid as we might expect. For example, Diamond shutting down.
Yeah.
And the whole industry kind of going into hibernation as a result. And then meanwhile, seeing publishers like SourcePoint and Scout and TKO being really nimble and figuring out kind of their own distribution methods. This seemed really instructive to me. As a creator, I feel like I've got the creative side down pretty well, and I've even got a decent chunk of the production side down pretty well. But things like printing, shipping, those are things that I did not know about until I started working on this campaign. So the other thing that it was kind of an unintended consequence of all this is that publishers' acquisitions timetables started to get longer and they started to get more narrow. I've been working on the OZ since 2017 in some capacity. And part of the reason why we're doing this Kickstarter is because I had written this as 6 single issues, and we had 2 of them done already. So I said, why not just put them together as a double-sized first issue? Whereas the publishers I was talking with, even the ones who were really excited and interested in this book, they were telling me, well, we don't think we can get this out until 2022.
Jeez.
And I just thought, you know, when the book looks this good and I'm this excited about it, you get restless. You don't want to wait another second. And I felt like Kickstarter lets me do that, where we get to promote the book. We get to plant our flag to say this book exists and here's where you can get it. And it also gives us a lot of flexibility in terms of frequency with it. Nobody's expecting the month-to-month release schedule that, you know, the direct market would. So I don't kill my art team with this. I mean, the book is written, like I said, it's entirely done. You know, we've drawn the first third of the book. And so we've got another 2/3 that we're in the process of putting together right now. And so that gives Ruben and Whitney and DC time to get that out without, you know, killing them.
Yeah.
And still kind of gives us room to put this out earlier than we could through any other distribution channel. And that's not to say that, like, I'm closing the door on publishers whatsoever. There have been plenty of books that have had a lot of Kickstarter success that have then found their way to the direct market. And I would love nothing more than that, to be honest. Like I said, it's all about that building that wider consensus. It's bringing people to the table. What I will say, however, is that, you know, because it's Kickstarter, I do believe in giving fans a bang for their buck. That's part of the reason why we're doing double-sized. We're planning to do 3 Kickstarters for this book, one for each issue, and then possibly a 4th one for a collection. But they're all going to be double-sized. The scripts are already written. It is set in stone. It will happen this way. But we're also offering some really cool rewards for people, stuff that you can't get at a comic shop. Because, you know, these are the people on Kickstarter. They're the early adopters. They're the ones who they might not be familiar with my work, and yet they're still willing to give us a shot based on the strength of the preview and the concept. So, for example, every single tier, down to our $5 thank you tier, you will get a free PDF of Spencer and Locke number one and Going to the Chapel number one.
Nice.
Just because I want everybody to feel like they get something out of this book, out of this Kickstarter experience. You know, then once you get on to our digital tiers, we're also offering behind the scenes materials. So you'll have PDFs of my script for this book, for these first two issues, or I guess this double-sized first issue. There will also be behind the scenes materials for Ruben's untouched inks, as well as Whitney's untouched colors. So for the process junkies, you can kind of see how it came together. But we've also got some really cool stuff for our more high rollers. You know, we've got original artwork from Ruben. You can get, you know, head sketches drawn from Ruben. You can get drawn into the book. Maybe you can be like a munchkin bystander. Something going on. We've got Skype meetings with me. You can talk to me about how to write a comic, or you can ask me to look at your pitch, or you can ask me how to navigate publicity or the Hollywood pipeline. You really get to set the agenda. My favorite reward, however, and it's extremely limited, but we are offering this. People have asked me for a long time, are you ever going to make Spencer and Locke plushies?
Oh my God.
And the answer has been, well, we haven't had time. You know, Action Lab controls the merchandising for that. And, you know, they're busy putting out books, but, I did have 10 handmade Spencer dolls created as a thank you gift for our creative team.
Nice.
And so we have 3 left over. And so, that's part of our King of the Jungle package. That's sort of for our premium backers. They are, as I say, super, 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 super rare. But you know, I believe strongly in a panther in every home. So, that is something we're offering. And then, last but not least, we're actually offering, a package called There's No Place Like Home. Once COVID subsides, I will do a signing at any comic shop in the continental US of your choosing. So that's kind of the ultimate collector's package. You get sort of everything. And I should also say, we've got some amazing variant covers, in store for this book as well. Ruben Rojas is doing our main cover, and it is just jaw dropping.
Beautiful. Yeah.
But we've also got some amazing variants, from Mon House, who's done variants for Spencer and Locke and Going to the Chapel. He's got our Winged Monkey Death from Above cover. We've got, Rio Burton, who's got, this amazing kind of movie poster style. I call it Apocalypse Oz poster. and then, this might be my favorite. I'm a little biased. Kenneth Wagnon from Hearts Full of Sand. I've been trying to work on something with him for ages. And, so he's got, an Akira inspired, hit and run cover featuring, Dorothy and the Tin Soldier. It is, incredible looking. It's something like this side of Danny Warren Johnson.
Nice.
It was so impressive that when he showed me the inks, I immediately asked him how much to buy it. and I have the original cover sitting right here with me. That's how incredible these covers are. But yeah, we've got something for kind of every level of involvement. Because yeah, you know, Kickstarter, it's a risk. You're rolling the dice.
For sure.
Yeah. You know, we think that every backer matters and every dollar matters. And so we want to make sure that our readers who are putting their trust in us and their faith in us, they feel like they get, some bang for their buck.
I have to say, David, I'm a little disappointed that there's not like a special like collector's tier for an eventual hardcover collection. But I understand that that's kind of not feasible when you're doing multiple Kickstarters.
Right? So, you know, I'll put a pin in it by saying if we manage to pull off our first 3 Kickstarters, we do have plans for a fourth one as a collected edition. But you know, it's all contingent on how the first 3 Kickstarters do.
Yeah.
you know. But yes, it is. We've got ideas. Really, you know, really the reason why we're staggering it this way is just so readers can get their hands on the book without having to wait too long in between installments. I believe we've got like an estimated delivery time of December for this. So it'll come, this first issue will come in around the holidays, and, you know, we're trying to do these things, quarterly, or something around that neck of the woods. So that way, like, it's not the same frequency as a monthly comics release, but it's not something that you have to wait a million years for it to come out.
Well, sure. And you're getting the double sized issue. So,
yeah. And, you know, the great thing about this book is that, the way that I wrote it, the issues pair together really nicely. The OZ fits in a three-act structure really well, I think probably better than anything I've written before. And so, you know, that was kind of one of the things that gave me permission to do this with Kickstarter, was like, oh, I can do this as double-sized, and it'll still feel organic, and it'll feel like our early adopters are really getting a nice hunk of storytelling for their hard-earned dollar. So, but yeah, I definitely, you know, it's in certain ways, it's kind of like a brave new world for me. I mean, you know, as my first Kickstarter, I'm constantly thinking about how can I reinvent things and how can I one-up myself. You know, just this week, I was working on designing some potential add-ons, you know, some stretch goals for the campaign. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know, it's a little nerve-wracking, you know. It feels a lot like Spencer and Locke. You know, you only get one chance to make a good first impression. But at the same time, when you're working with a team as talented as the team I'm working with, it's hard not to feel confident in their work, if not your own.
I can see that. I mean, if you've been working on it for this long, and I've seen the preview pages, they look great. So I'm definitely going to be in on it. You know, and the thing is, I usually don't like to do Kickstarters that are single issues, and yes, I know that this is a double sized,
yeah, of course.
But I love your work, man. So that's why I had to talk to you, and I'm gonna be doing the Kickstarter anyway.
I appreciate it. It means the world, and you know, and like I said, I don't, the advantage of working on creator owned is that, you know, it succeeds and fails based on your drive and your values for the work.
Yeah.
You know, I've worked with other publishers who I love working with, but you know, the higher up you go and the more that you're dealing with editorial, there's sort of more of that game of telephone. You lose that element of control mm-hmm. with it. You know, you're not just trying to make the story work, but you're also trying to make sure that, you know, you write something that your editors are cool with.
Right.
And you know, that's been a wonderful experience. You know, I love working with the editors I've been working with. But something like the OZ, it there's no compromise here. This book is being told and delivered exactly the way I want it to. And there's something really empowering about that. As a creator, it really feels like you don't have to wait for permission anymore. If you have an idea and you feel passionate about it, you can just put it out there. And, you know, that's a hard lesson that I've had to pick up during COVID, but I think it's one that I'll be taking with me for the rest of my career.
I wish you the best of luck in the Kickstarter, man. I'm excited. I know I was talking to a few friends of mine. They're going to be in on it as well. So
I appreciate it. Thank you for spreading the word. It means a ton.
Yeah, it's a total pleasure, man. I'll have the link in the show notes and all that. And the Kickstarter launches August 17th.
Yep, that's it. And if anybody wants to find us online, you can follow the book. You can follow the OZ comic. It's just one word on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at PeposD or David Pepos Comics at Facebook. You can subscribe to my newsletter, Pep Talks, at bit.ly/pepnews.
Why haven't I done that?
you should do that. Last but not least, you can find the Kickstarter page. It'll be bit.ly/theozcomic. Everybody who's listening, you know, we really appreciate you taking the time. We really appreciate your consideration and your support. Because, every indie creator owes their success to their fans and their readers. And I never want to forget that. And I always want to, you guys are the ones that make me want to bring my A game to every project. And I'm not going to let you down.
Awesome. Thank you, David.
Of course, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, man. Best of luck.